This just in. The Union Pacific Railway is cutting back a shipment of fertilizer to the nation's farmers. In other words, the Union Pacific is cutting back its shipments of food to you and me. This leads us to ask, will our farmers be able to grow enough food for us to eat?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1313th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Hey, perhaps you're among our friends up there in Calgary who are tuned into the Food Chain Podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Folks, we begin with Michael Olson's first law of the food chain. Agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles. Why begin there? Well, because as we look around, it appears as though much of the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles is crumbling at our feet. We see that Russia has invaded the Ukraine, and as a consequence, Europe's breadbasket has been emptied, and the world's predominant supply of fertilizers have been cut off. We see the links in our food chain breaking, and our transportation systems finding it ever more difficult to send fertilizer and receive grain. We see many of our food processing plants erupting in mysterious flames. We hear our leaders tell us to never let a serious crisis go to waste, and to use this serious crisis to grow crops with manures and compost instead of chemical fertilizers. But wait, did we not hear those same leaders tell us just last week that we need to get rid of all of our farm animals because of their flatulence, how that flatulence might cause the globe to warm up? Well, when the foundation starts crumbling, it's time to start rebuilding. And to my way of thinking, a good place to start rebuilding agriculture and our culture is to rebuild our soil. And who better to help us do that than Neil Kinsey, who is the author of Hands-On Agronomy and the chief agronomist at Kinsey Ag. Neil, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you, Michael. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, pleasure to have you aboard. They're currently down there in the Sedona area in Arizona helping farmers build their soil, correct?
Well, yes, farmers and gardeners, I'd say.
Good. Yeah. Well, good. Because we all live on the soil when it gets right down to it, do we not?
Yes, that's right.
Well, Neil, I've been following you for years in the pages of Acres USA, where you come up with these great articles like deep nutrient sampling and the dangers of using too much lime and considering the effects of potassium on manganese and soil fertility. You've been really speaking to people who need to keep their soil fertile. And in thinking of soil fertility, I almost think of it as a never-ending stew on the stove that you have to keep adding ingredients to. And it takes a very special chef to keep a stew going. And it must take some very special knowledge to keep a soil brewing as a living organism. And you kind of put a specific kind of knowledge on the table, a lot of which seems to come from a guy named William Albrecht. Is that true?
Yes, that's absolutely true. I have learned so much from the works of Dr. Albrecht.
Would you tell us a little bit about him and what he sees as the essential core of soil chemistry?
Well, Dr. Albrecht actually began his career after completing his doctorate at University of Illinois as a soil microbiologist at the University of Missouri. His first job at the university was to teach farmers how to use rhizobium bacteria and on getting the legumes they were growing to germinate properly. Each one of those legume seeds needed a different type of rhizobium bacteria, and that was new knowledge at the time. So Dr. Albrecht went to work thinking, well, if we can get the farmers to use the right rhizobium bacteria on their alfalfa or their peas or their beans or their Lespediza, whatever legume they may be growing, then we're going to solve the big problem because a lot of farmers couldn't get it to grow properly. Well,
And if you can, if you can't get your legumes to grow properly, you can't get the nitrogen into the soil, correct?
That is correct. But also, as Dr. Albrecht used to always say, the legumes produce proteins. Proteins are go foods. The grasses and so forth produce carbohydrates. Carbohydrates are the grow foods. Go foods give you energy. Grow foods build you up. And he said, as long as we balance out the two, that's fine. But he said, we're putting too much emphasis on grow foods and not enough on go foods, the ones that give you energy.
And there's
this was what he...
There's a lot of that could be applied to our current diets. Is that true?
Absolutely.
If you look at the shape of us walking down the street, too much grow foods, not enough go foods.
We consume so much in terms of carbohydrates as compared to proteins from whatever source. At any rate, he was forecasting this in the 1930s and 1940s. And what happened was he was working with the farmers, and when they put the right inoculants, the rhizobium inoculants on the proper seed, some of those farmers, it was just like magic, because now they could grow great alfalfa, they could grow great peas or beans. But for some farmers, it didn't seem to work at all. And then for other farmers, some spots did well, other places didn't do well, right in the same field. So he said, well, the answer that we need is to get the rhizobium to work, but there's something else that the rhizobium is not always working. And that's when he started looking at the composition of soils and what was needed in order to grow legumes. And in the process of getting that straightened out, all of a sudden the farmer said, well, after we take the field out of legumes or alfalfa or whatever and put it in corn silage for our dairy cows, it grows better corn silage too. So he started looking at the makeup of the soils and found that overall in general, and a lot of people will disagree with this, but we have found it true in 75 countries all over the world where we work. Any plant needs a general nutrient content in a soil. If that soil gets in within a general level, at least the plant can grow if it has the right growing conditions, meaning enough water and the proper environment, heat and cold and so forth. But the very best cactus here in Arizona grow in the most fertile areas. People just don't try and take a look at that or whatever. But it's not just cactus. It's the evergreen trees. It's the juniper. It's vegetables. It's grass. It's grapes, whatever.
And that would be like saying the best people grow from the best food.
You know what? Dr. Albrecht also said that. And he actually took the soils of the state of Missouri and analyzed those soils. And he said, you know, where the soils have the best nutrient makeup to grow the best crops, that's the area where the best-known people or well-known people came from. There were specific areas of Missouri, particularly northwestern and north-central Missouri, down into the center of the state, where most of the very well-known Missourians actually grew up. That included Walt Disney, J.C. Penney, General Omar Bradley. There are a lot of names that can be used there, but later on he was actually hired by I'm not sure if it was the Department of Navy or U.S. government or who, but he was actually hired to go over the health records of soldiers that had been killed in World War I, World War II. And he actually could pick out where the people the servicemen from Missouri, what area they came from, before even looking to see where they were by looking at their health records.
Wow. And a lot of those health records reflected their dental condition and so on. So he could just...
Yes, in particular. Dental condition, and also he said that, I've not seen this written down, but once talking to him personally, he said that the arteries of some of the 20-year-olds that came from the less fertile areas look like they might have been from someone that was 80 years old.
Wow. So if it's in the soil, it's in the plant. And if it's in the plant, it can be in the body. But if it's not in the soil, what happens then to the plant?
If it's not in the soil, then the plant's going to have problems. It may be a problem with producing seed. It may be a problem with just growth, depending on what nutrients are lacking, because we find there's, as you said about making the stew, there's a lot of things that have to go in it, but if you get way too much salt, then that's not going to be one that's going to be good for you to eat, because it won't taste good or whatever. Mm-hmm. Well, in terms of the soil, it's the other way. It's the nutritional values that really matter. And once you correct those nutritional values, it shows up in the, well, in the food and in whatever consumes it. One example that just comes to mind really quick, a dairyman in New Zealand with 1,200 cows started out using this program and putting the nutrients that showed to be required by a detailed analysis, which was developed by Dr. William Albrecht back in the 30s and 40s. It's not new. But most people reject it because they say, oh, that's old science. Well, it's accurate science. This dairyman, in 1 year, reduced his vet bill by $95,000.
Wow.
And he said, I've never seen anything like it. He said, the health of the cows are just so different just by adding what was showing to be missing to get I'm not saying that you can make a poor soil into an excellent soil in 1 year, because it's like you said, you've got to work at it. And even once you get that soil into excellent shape, if you don't keep working it, you got to put back what you're taking away. Mm-hmm. And too many people think, well, once we get it a great soil, we can just coast. Well, if you've got a really heavy clay soil, maybe you can coast longer than you could if you're on a sand. But people that are working on sands have to be constant at it, putting small amounts at a time, whereas clay soils, if you get them way out of whack, it costs a lot to correct them.
Well, a good fertile soil really is like a good stew on the stove, is it not? You can get it going, but you always have to keep it going. And to keep it going, it takes a very sensitive chef with a good palate who can taste or perceive what's missing, and in what's missing, perhaps what needs to be replaced. But there's a lot of sensitivity involved in that, because I can put a stew on the stove and keep it going for a little while, but keeping it going for a long time is a whole other issue. But we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about soil fertility and how to address it. You brought up something very interesting about old technology, and that's perhaps where I'd like to start that conversation. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for What's Eating What. Hey, you know, that's what we're talking about, What's Eating What. Living Soil, with Neil Kinsey, who is the author of Hands-On Agronomy and Chief Agronomist at Kinsey Ag. And you, right back.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's getting weird out there. Why do I say that? Well, the President of the United States says there's going to be a food shortage. My goodness, here in the United States of America, a food shortage in the land of the plenty? Well, let's ask Neil Kinsey. Neil, you're a man well-grounded in the soil, as it were, and with somebody who's really got his feet planted in the ground. Do you think things are really as weird as they look?
I'm afraid that things are going to get out of hand for more reasons than one. First of all, when you start hearing people talk about a food shortage, then there are certain people that would begin hoarding. Well, we're going to hold on to this because the price is probably going to go up. Then we can make more money out of it. And sometimes food shortages are created in order to make more money. As far as the necessity for a food shortage, I don't believe if we ever looked at the soils and what they could do in terms of quality plus quantity that we'd ever have a food shortage. But, well, let me just put it this way. From the soils that we see, I believe we could double the production of most soils in the U.S. and other countries if we just paid more attention to putting the nutrients on that we're taking away instead of what makes the most tonnage. That's the real key to me. Farmers are getting paid for tons. How many tons can you produce? And most of the time it has absolutely nothing to do with the quality of what's being grown there. I feel like if we started putting far more emphasis on the nutrient values of the foods and the feeds that we grow and pay people to do it, all of a sudden we'd have a much different agriculture. Back in the 1950s, the Council of Economic Advisors to the President of the U.S. published, and I believe it was 1953, I do have a copy of the book back home and so forth, and you can turn right to it. But the Council of Economic Advisors told the President in that time, look, we need to concentrate on low-priced food. Why did they say that? They say it right on the same page. This way, people have more disposable income to spend on consumer items. It wasn't a matter of keeping the food cost low in order to supply nutrients and so forth, because when you start concentrating on keeping a low food price, then that means you're not going to be paying people for growing quality. You're going to be paying them for growing whatever makes the least and the most tons, give you the least amount of price. At least this is how it's worked out. So, yes, I think we're going to have a problem with certain types of food, and it would be a good idea if you know where to get it and what to do with it to at least put up some stores for some time to come. I used to have a friend and his parents actually worked on farms, and they didn't know how much work they'd have in the wintertime. So in the fall of the year, they'd take money and go and buy a couple of 50-pound bags of sugar, a couple of 50-pound bags of potatoes, potatoes didn't last long, but of wheat and beans and things that had long-lasting value, and put them in the pantry so they'd be sure they had something to eat all winter. I would say if you have the wherewithal and the know how to cook beans and how to make bread from wheat, then this might be a good time to put something in the storage.
Well, like I learned in Boy Scouts, be prepared.
Yes.
Because if our president is telling us there's going to be a food shortage, I don't know, that's an awful big voice in the theater crying fire. So maybe we should. You know, you talk about going back in time for other technology, older technologies, and how those of us who live in modern times always tend to find ways to denigrate that technology. But in the year 1900, F.H. King, who was the Secretary of Agriculture at the time, went to Asia and toured the agriculture over there. And in 1911, he came out with a book called Farmers of 40 Centuries. And he pointed out to the fact that farmers in China, farmers of 40 centuries, have been farming the same property, the same soil for 40 centuries. And in 1900, the population of China was 400 million people, which is a third, again, more than we have here today. And in China, they have one-fifth the arable land that we have. So, you know, I keep thinking about that farmer of 40 centuries. How on earth did he manage to keep his soil so fertile without having any modern way of looking at that soil fertility? I mean, he didn't have any William Albrecht to talk him through it. How did they get that information, do you think?
Well, let's use a more current example. It's an older example as far as I'm concerned, because I'm talking about the late 70s and early 80s. But back in that time period, I had an opportunity to start working with soils in Europe. And one of my clients there had a PhD in agriculture, and he farmed about 1,500 acres of cropland and 5,000 acres of timber. But he also had land in the U.S., and that's how I met him, because he had a farm very close to us, and his business manager recommended that he use our services on that farm, and we improved the yield so much. He said, "You have to come to Germany to help me on the farms there." I said to him, "You know, how long did you say your farm manager had been with you in Germany?" "Well, 35 years. I said, "And what did you say? You had one field that you had a crop disaster in terms of your wheat yield, and that was 90 bushels per acre, right?" And he, "Yes." I said, "But over here, the most we've helped you make is 100 bushels per acre. And this farm manager is going to have trouble having confidence in what we say." So the farm manager pulled samples from the good areas and the poor areas, sent them to us. And when we looked at those, their yields were where they should be, because they had much higher nutrition. These farms had been farmed for 900 to 1,000 years. They had much better nutrient levels than the farms that we had over here that had only been farmed for 100 years. And I could not figure that out. Why is it that someone that have the land's been farmed for 1,000 years, they're making heavier test weights, they're making more yield, they're making more nutritious yield on land that's been farmed for 1,000 years? What's the matter? They were farming just like we were. When I went over there, they took pride in saying, "We have adopted the American way of farming," because that was get big and so on and so forth. And I'm not against getting big. I'm just saying that they, when you looked at it, you would say, "Well, they're doing just like we're doing." What was the difference? As we were going to one of his farms, we passed by a little 10-acre, very nice, neat-looking little home with a barn and a few animals. And out in the field, they had placed manure in small piles. And whatever way you looked, whatever way you looked, you could see a line, you know, straight ahead of you, looked to the side, and it was all lined up really nice. And I said, "That's really unusual." And he said, "Neil, until just recently, that's the way all of our farmland was farmed." His father had 10,000 acres that they actually farmed around Wolfsburg, but he said, "We had a person on every 10 to 20 acres, and they did it just like this. Every year they used the manure from the livestock that dairy would support, put it on the soils." What happens over all those years, they started putting on the manures in small amounts in it. Oh, I didn't say this. This is light soils, considered some of the worst soils in Lower Saxony, and they're making higher yields than we make. Well, when you looked at it, it had to do with all the nutrients we don't measure and put on all the time. And this, the key was putting on that manure, which was fresh manure out of the barns, or you might say composted through the winter and then put on in the spring or whatever. But when they put that on, it was just small amounts, but over years and years and years, that added up. Mm-hmm. Because what you find is moderation is really the key to getting a good response. You don't want to over, you find out something's needed and start pouring it on, eventually it's going to cause a problem instead of causing help.
So what do you think of our political leaders who are now telling us that we must take advantage of this crisis, as whatever it is, and do things differently, which is to, instead of using chemical fertilizers and that come from who knows where, we should be using manures and compost. But then on the other hand, we need to get rid of our farm animals because they cause global warming. It seems like quite a contradiction there.
Well, it seemed like a very big contradiction to me as well, and also a very uninformed one. I don't have it right at hand, but there have been studies that have been made, and they're looking at it from a different direction. So it depends on whose approach you take. But those who have looked at the benefits of having livestock actually show through scientific research and so forth that when you use livestock in your process of growing food, you actually capture and build the most carbon in the soil, not destroy it like so many people are saying. In other words, to capture carbon in the soil, when you start using livestock, whether they're grazing on pastures or whether you're using the manure to make compost or anything, and as I say, I'm not, my brain doesn't bring back the exact thing, but I could always go back and look this up and send it to you for later use if we needed to.
I believe it. When you put manure, when you put organic matter in the soil in a reasonable way, you're just building the soil and its ability to capture and hold moisture, to capture and hold nutrients. But what happens when we turn the other way to the modern technologies brought to us by chemistry and use the synthetically derived nutrients, which is a real easy way of doing it when you think about it? For the folks that don't know, what Neil is talking about is feeding the soil so the soil can feed the plant. What modern technologies do is they essentially say, to heck with the soil, we'll just feed the plant directly. And that's how you end up with things like hydroponic organic food. Neil?
Well, that's one of the reasons for that, yes. But when we look at feeding the soil versus feeding the plant, it's not just a matter of saying, okay, let's buy all the fertilizer and put it onto that feed, you know, that'll feed the soil. Actually, when I was first studying under Dr. Albrecht back in the 1960s, he would always point out, at that time, the quote experts were saying, soil isn't really needed except to hold the plant up. We can supply the fertilizer, so we only need that to hold up the plant. Well, that's where a lot of hydroponics have come from. Now they use wires to hold up the plants and try to put everything through water. Well, if we ever get to the point where we measure nutrient density, and I know that's talked about a lot, but it's not done that often. But when we get to the point where nutrient density or getting good high levels of all the various nutrients into a food source, once that's there, then what you find is we can't guess at what a plant needs. The soil has so many more elements in it that we don't even know how to measure, but it may not need enough. We can measure it and say, oh, we need this little trillionth of a piece. But basically, all the nutrients that are in the soil have to have a way of getting into the plant. And if we take the soil itself and say, okay, we're just going to isolate what we can measure and put that into the plants, which is what you're doing when you go hydroponic, how much are we leaving out? I'm afraid we're leaving out most of it, most of the things that give us the best health. Bulk, again, if you want to go bulk so you can keep your stomach full, well, that's one thing. But if you want to grow what keeps everything going, that's different.
Is you talk about not knowing, you know, what to put in the soil or what is in the soil when it gets right down to it. But is there any way of knowing what the plant's exact requirements are when they need it. I mean, people get hungry for things, and that hunger is kind of our way of telling us we need this or that we need that. Not counting sugars and things like that to trick our taste, but we have that taste. But is there any way for a farmer to know exactly what the nutrient requirements of his crop are at any one time?
Well, there are people who say, oh, absolutely, because all they're looking at is how many tons they can grow. But what I would say is there are much better tools that we can use than are actually being used at this time, specifically to do very detailed soil analysis, which that's not really how fertilizer is sold. Right. Fertilizer, I put on a meeting, a training course for 40 to 60 field men for about 3 or 4 different fertilizer companies. And we did this for 6 or 7 years in a row. And after about the 7th year, one of the fellows that had been selling fertilizer through this company for 25 years had me come and go visit with him to visit his clients that were using the program. And on the way, he said, you know, Neil, I have been a fertilizer salesman for 25 years, and we always took soil tests. But when we took the soil test, we'd fill out a sheet and say how much yield we wanted to make. And when the soil test came back, it would tell you this is what to do from this soil test to make this yield. But he said it was all based on what yield you put down. It really wasn't based on what the levels were on the soil test.
We're going to take a quick break, but that's the way it is. And it's about tonnage and not about nutrition. And boy, are we in a fix now. When we get back, how do we make that soil fertile? With the help of Neil Kinsey. Right back.
History buffs, this tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place aboard the USS Dale during the opening moments, 7 December 1941.
As we left our berth and got underway, the deck force was still engaged in getting ready for combat. Fuller had the job of clearing the deck of all the wooden objects that had collected in port, so Fuller was making his way aft, just tossing stuff like a madman, when he came to the ice cream freeze. Before he could toss it over the side, one of the guys said, "Hey, wait a minute!" In a matter of seconds, the lock was broken and the ice cream distributed among the crew. So, what you saw that morning was the USS Dale steaming hell-bent out to the channel while the guys back aft were standing by their guns, eating ice cream, and watching World War II break out all around.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com.
Are you nearly maxed out on your credit cards? It doesn't matter if you're using your credit cards for fun or to survive. At the end of the month, your statements come in, and you can either pay them or you can't. If you can't, late fees and interest rates get tacked on, and now you're struggling just to make the minimum payment due. Do you feel trapped? Am I talking to you? Good, because I personally researched some companies that can help you. They may be able to reduce your credit card balances by 50% and stop the late fees. If you qualify, please call our special debt hotline number right now for a complimentary, free 5-minute consultation. Deal with your credit card problem now before it gets much worse and put more money back in your pocket. Trust me, I've been there too. Call right now.
800-370-8128. 800-370-8128. 800-370-8128. That's 800-370-8128.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Polyface Farms, Joel Salatin.
Few how-to books could be more appropriate for our times than MetroFarm, a truly comprehensive manual. MetroFarm makes the whole embedded food system doable. It's a must-read.
USDA Director Bud Kerr.
Big book. MetroFarm describes the agronomic, economic, and managerial concepts required to generate substantial profits from agricultural locales near metropolitan areas.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning Metro Farm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
We are with the Doctor of Soil. He is Neil Kinsey, author of Hands-On Agronomy, a chief consultant for a chief, that's what you do. You consult with farmers who need to bring their soil into a situation where it's fertile and can produce the optimum quality of crops. And when we talk about optimum quality, we're really talking about the nutrient content of those crops, not necessarily the tonnage. I guess the best way of getting the big tonnage, Neil, would be to pour on the nitrogen, right?
Well, for certain crops, yes. For legumes, not necessarily, but for grass crops, that's the big concept, is pour on the nitrogen. And if you're looking at, I didn't say this up to now, but we work with all types of growers. We work with farmers who use conventional fertility, and we work with farmers who are 100% certified organic, but we also work with small gardeners and people with flower gardens and so on and so forth. We work with all sizes of growers, whatever it is they may be wanting to grow. But what we find is, in terms of working with conventional farmers, the nitrogen is overused. But in working with organic farmers, many times nitrogen turns out to be their biggest limiting factor in terms of profitability. Not overuse of nitrogen, but the cost of nitrogen that they get is so high being organic, or they feel like it's so high because they don't know what kind of difference it will make, that they just don't put enough nitrogen on. So what I would say is, in terms of looking at nitrogen, it depends on who we're talking about and what they're doing and what they have to do, because in certain cases, unless you put more nitrogen on, that is the limiting factor to growing not just tonnage, but to growing a healthy food.
Okay. And where do we get enough nitrogen? I mean, there aren't many of us, Neil, that have farm animals anymore.
No, but we have many resources, and it depends on what restrictions you want to put on those resources. For example, we work with tremendous amounts of organic growers. Some are small, some are quite large. In general, the third of the clients we have that are some type of natural or organic will be much smaller in terms of acreage than the conventional farmers. But we have farmers that farm several thousand acres that are organic. And where do they get their nitrogen? Well, first, if we can utilize it, it's from compost. But the thing that happens is organic growers don't realize that if they start using inordinate amounts of compost in order to get the nitrogen that's in it, they start overdoing other nutrients. And in particular, the phosphorus and potassium keeps going up, 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 not by how much is in the compost, but by how much that compost is stimulating organisms in the soil that reduce other phosphorus and potassium that's in unavailable forms that are so-called locked up or tied up in that soil. And as the phosphorus continues to get higher and higher, if it gets to be excessive, which can be measured, it starts tying up zinc. If it gets extremely high, it also starts tying up copper. Well, what's zinc necessary for? A farmer understands when we tell him this. Zinc is necessary for moisture absorption into the plant. So we can get phosphate so high that it takes more water to grow the same crop. If in terms of copper, what does copper do? Copper gives stalk strength and resilience, but it also fights rust and fungus diseases. And so we get our phosphorus too high, start tying up the copper. We get weak stalks, and we get more rust and fungus disease. Now, phosphorus is not the only culprit there. Nitrogen can cause a certain amount of problem, but copper and boron are the two elements that help control more than anything else, whether you're organic or conventional, help control rust and fungus diseases. If you get everything else right, you don't have those, you're going to have the problem. With too much potassium, what happens? First thing that happens with too much potassium is once it gets to excessive, which is 7.5% of the holding capacity of any soil, and you can measure that capacity. But once it gets above that, it starts tying up the boron. Boron's the other side of fighting rust and fungus diseases. And if it gets high enough so that the potassium and sodium together take up 10% of the nutrient-holding ability of the soil, it starts blocking out manganese uptake.
Well, Neil, this takes us back to the stew on the stove. I mean, it takes a very clever chef to keep a stew going, and what you're talking about seems like it takes a lot of clever intelligence to figure out how to keep a soil going. What happens? Why do people call you in the first place? Is it because they look at their plants and see that something's wrong?
Most of the time, the reason someone contacts us is because we do say that we specialize in problem soil. We don't say we'll straighten out your problem soil in 1 year. But we can take a look. If you've got soils that are going the way you want them to and other soils that are not, you take samples out of what you want them to grow like and take samples out of the soil that's not going that way, send them to us. We say, don't tell us which is good and which is bad. If we're going to help you, we ought to be able to pick that out. And so some of these growers and so forth will find, hey, you really did help my problem. It's not my problem soil anymore. Now I've got some other soil that don't do as well as what used to be my problems. And as a consequence, we keep getting more and more business from people who use the program. But at the same time, when you start looking at that, they also tell their neighbors, and most of the time, the way we get calls is either somebody reads hands on agronomy and thinks it makes sense, or they talk to someone else who's doing the program. Mm-hmm.
So when somebody sends you their soil, you put it in the soup and taste it, right? How do you taste soil as you do?
Well,
as you being the soil of the chef of the soil, how do you taste it?
Well, thankfully, I happened to be in the right place at the right time. And that was, I was at University of Missouri, and I asked a student there why we could take old swampland and drain it and put soybeans in the first year to grow 50 bushel. Soil test said you didn't need anything, and we believed it because nobody was making 50 bushel on the land they'd been farming. But then the next year you put soybeans there, and you made 40 bushel, and the next year you made 30. And in that area, if you didn't grow soybeans, no other crops grew well at all. So it was continuous soybeans. Well, after the first 2 years, from then on, it stayed at about 30 bushels per acre. That's what it was. Soil test said you still didn't need anything. I met Dr. Albrecht, and he said, Neil, how did you determine that? I said, well, we determined it was soil tests. He said, what did you have on your soil test? pH, phosphorus, and potassium. He shook his head yes, and he said, Neil, the problem is you didn't do a detailed enough soil test. He said, first of all, what was your pH? Well, our pHs were 7.374. Well, he said, that pH, if you just look at pH, they're going to tell you you don't need any limestone. But he said, I know the soils in your area, and you're going to need anywhere from 1 to 5 tons of limestone to collect those soil. But he said, pH doesn't tell you whether you need lime or not. But he said, most agriculture say that's how you tell the lime. Mm-hmm. He said, pH tells you one thing. If you have a low pH, then you need lime. If you have a high pH, he said, if you have a low pH, you have too little of something. And basically, you're going to need some lime to take care of that. But if you have a high pH, what that's telling you is you have too much of something. And he said, every time you have too much of one thing, you won't have enough of something else. Find out what your deficiencies are and take care of those. That's the first key to controlling all excesses.
And again, that's pretty good dietary advice, too, for people who eat food. You're eating too much of one thing, you're probably depleting something else.
Yes. Same kind of principle. And those principles hold true all the way up and down the food chain. Mm-hmm.
So when people send you their soil, you can actually look into it and judge which nutrients they're in. And I suppose the first thing you look for is the pH, correct?
Well, actually, it is not. Oh. What we tell our clients is the only thing pH tells us is if we're low, we're going to need to come up with some nutrients that are generally missing in a soil such as calcium and perhaps magnesium, especially if it's sand, magnesium as well. But when you have a high pH, it tells you you have too much of something, but it doesn't tell you what you've got. So the first thing we look at on a soil test is what is that soil ability to attract and hold plant nutrients, and that is measured by the amount of organic matter and colloidal clay that soil has, because the clay and the humus actually have negative charges, and they attract elements that have positive charges, such as calcium, magnesium, potassium, and sodium. And those are the four key elements that influence pH. So first of all, we need to know what the holding capacity of the soil is. Secondly, once we know what that holding capacity is, then what is the range that each one of those positively charged elements need to be in? And the ones that most influence pH are the ones that have the most influence on the fertility of that soil in terms of initial productivity, because those four elements, calcium, magnesium, potassium, and sodium, actually control the porosity of the soil, which controls the amount of air and water we have in the soil. And if we have a long amount of any of that, it's going to restrict aeration or water. And what are the four things we need in order to sustain life? Shelter, food, water, air. Which ones are the most critical? Air and water. Those are also the most critical in the soil.
Wow, so looking for that. You know, often thought that the chemical interactions of the soil, a lot like shopping, are they not? You know, things are being bought and sold there all the time.
They are by the microbes and the life of the soil and the plant roots. They're always exchanging back and forth and so forth. But on the other hand, we need to have certain levels of each one of the things that are... I'm not trying to imply here that we can measure everything a soil needs. What I would say is the nutrients that are required in the most abundance are the nutrients that we have been able to measure. Once we get those within a certain range where you can say, well, this range is where these soils need in order to produce well and produce really good nutritious crops, which proves out if you're someone that does it and grow your feed for your own livestock, it proves out that yes, this really is the right thing to do, because all of a sudden it influences not only the weight gains of the livestock, but it also influences their health. And I've been on a farm in Australia. The farmer raises grass-fed beef on 4,000 acres, and he raises them up to 1,200 pounds and sells them to the buyer. And you go out there and those steers are 1,000 to 1,200 pounds. They still have a sparkle in their eye. They still have shiny hair coats. And they still are as lively as a young calf. They still have that much energy. They're not dragging around like you see so many cattle in a feedlot or something like that. They're lively. They've got life.
Which makes for good food, don't you think?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. That makes for good food because, well... this is something that most people haven't become aware of yet because it hasn't been published. They're making sure they have every T crossed and I dotted before it's published. But at University of Missouri right now, research is being done through the USDA on using Dr. Albrecht's soil fertility methods versus using the normal recommended fertility for growing corn and soybean. This has been going on for 7 years. It's randomized, replicated plots. They measure the yield. They measure the nutrient content as far as feed value. If you took that corn and soybeans and fed it to livestock, they measure the populations of the microbes in the soil, and they also measure how much carbon is being put back into the soil. And in every case, the Albrecht method exceeds any other method that's found. And this is not someone that set out to prove Dr. Albrecht is right. They said, we just want to make comparisons to see how much difference can it make if someone uses Dr. Albrecht's program as compared to the general program for growing corn and soybean. Mm-hmm. So what happens is they said it's higher yield, it's higher nutrition, it's higher microbial populations in the soil, and it's putting more carbon back into the soil, and they had the resources to measure all of that, and nobody came in and said, hey, we want you to do this study. The people that were doing the study said, we have enough funds that we can take care of this. We don't need to have someone to finance it. So there's nobody in there buying, you know, buying something to be said or anything. It's just a matter of the research and just using pure research to show what's there.
Neil Kinsey, do you think we can build enough soil to save our culture here in the United States?
Yes, I do. I think we can. Whether we will or not is another question. The reason I say I think we can is because we really did start out in 1973 working with farmers that had problem soils. In fact, when I finished my course of study under Dr. Albrecht, he said, Neil, now when you go out, just you might as well expect this. You're not going to get any good soil. He said, everything, the farmer may not say it, but if he has you do some work, it's going to be because he's got a problem. And I said, well, why do you say that? And he said, because the University of Missouri does soil tests for free, and you're going to charge. He said, if people aren't having any trouble, they're not going to pay for having you do this if they're having a problem. But he said, if you will stick with those farmers, show them what to do, it won't be long until their problem area will outperform some other part of their farm. And then they'll say, well, that's not my problem anymore. This is.
And there you go. Well, we're out of time, Neil Kinsey, but thank you so much for joining us, folks. Remember Michael Olson's first law of the food chain. Agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles. Thank you for helping us build our sandcastles, Neil.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.